Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Steve. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's a real treat to see so many people here. And again, thank you to the staff at Zingerman's Grey Line. This is a great spot for the event. I'm glad we've got so many people to come out for this great panel. This is a special treat for me in the job that I had before I came to Michigan Radio last year. I covered sports for an NPR program. So to get back into that with such a great group is a real treat. And I'd like to introduce the panel now. Joanne C. Gerstner in the middle is an award-winning sports journalist and author, also the sports journalist in residence at Michigan State University's School of Journalism. She's a regular contributor to the New York Times, NPR, BBC, and the U.S. Olympic Committee, as well as a frequent speaker and expert on sports neurology and concussion, women's in sports, and international athletics. Her 2016 book, Back in the Game, Why Concussion Doesn't Have to End Your Athletic Career, was just named as a Best Book Clarion Award winner by the Association for Women in Communications. And she's a 2013 U of M Knight Wallace Fellow and is glad to be back in Ann Arbor tonight. To my immediate left is John U. Bacon, a familiar voice and face for many Michigan radio listeners. John is our sports commentator. You can hear him regularly on Morning Edition and on Stateside. John's also the author of 9 books on sports, business, and health and history. Earlier this year, he published Playing Hurt, the memoir of longtime ESPN host John Saunders, who recently passed away. John's latest book just came out this month, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. Please welcome John U. Bacon. And at my far left, Jimmy King was a member of the University of Michigan's legendary Fab Five team that went to 2 consecutive NCAA basketball title games. Jimmy made 4 consecutive tournament appearances and went on to play professionally in the NBA. Today, Jimmy is an entrepreneur and a philanthropist. Since his playing days, he's done a lot of work with youth sports. In the past, he founded and ran a tech company based on solar technology, and he's also worked in finance. And right now, he is the vice president of True Champions. That's a group that helps students transition academically from high school to college with tutoring and coaching. Please welcome Mr. Jimmy King. As Steve mentioned, we're going to leave plenty of time for questions at the end, so we'll look forward to hearing from you. So if you think of something, please keep it in mind as we go along in the evening. Tonight, we're going to start the panel discussion with the protests in the NFL. And I'd like to ask the audience for some help here. How many people, please, a show of hands on each of these, how many people think that more than 50 players protested the anthem in this weekend's games? More than 30 players. More than 10. Okay, so a lot of people think more than 10. So this weekend through the afternoon games on Sunday, there were 4 players who did not stand for the anthem. One oddity in that group was Marshawn Lynch's. Marshawn Lynch has been sitting for the anthem, but the Raiders and Patriots played in Mexico. He sat for the U.S. anthem, then stood for the Mexican anthem. So that's an unusual situation because there aren't usually 2 anthems. So despite the fact that fewer and fewer players are protesting, the protests are still making a lot of news. And there's talk about the ratings being down in the NFL. Maybe that's because of that, maybe not. There's talk about sponsors being concerned. John, what's the, in your view, what's the end game here as this continues on, as we head toward the end of the season, the Super Bowl?
Me first. What about these guys over here? Very smart people.
You sat in the wrong chair.
I'm in the hot seat. I've got mixed feelings about the whole thing. My dad's a patriot, served in the Army, my grandfather in the Navy in World War II. When I was coaching the Ann Arbor Huron High School hockey team, we took it very seriously, the anthem. However, what I find utterly aggravating is when people criticize these guys and ask, well, what are you, avoiding the anthem for? They've made it very clear what they're avoiding the anthem for, and it's police brutality against innocent individuals. And what I admire about this is that if they've got a lot to lose and nothing to gain that I can see personally for doing so, so they're using their platform, which is a rare chance, to speak up for those who cannot do so. I think the one criticism I can say is what you mentioned is a lack of an end game. Right? What are you shooting for? When does the revolution end, if you will? And obviously you're not going to end police brutality overnight. That's not going to happen. But if they had a spokesman in charge, money to be raised, clinics, courses, whatever, awareness, meetings with law enforcement, 95% of whom, if not much more, understand exactly what they're talking about and are on their side, I think. If they had that set up, it probably would have ended sooner with more tangible results. And I think that's what's missing here are tangible results.
Jimmy, the NBA has a different situation than the NFL where there's a specific rule about standing in I believe the language is in a dignified posture or a dignified pose during the anthem. So that's not as much of an option for a player, but that, you know, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf protested in the 90s nonetheless. What are athletes who are trying to balance a political message with their careers? What are they going through if you want to make a statement, but you have that pressure from the league around you too?
Well, I think that a lot of guys, when they're faced with these requests to, I call them requests, because they still have a choice to either stand or to stand for the anthem. I think what goes through most athletes' minds is that it's not about their livelihood. That's not what it's about. It's like John said, it's about the platform that they're using because they have it. It's not that they're drawing attention to themselves. It's not about them. The ones who do that is clear to see. You'll find that out very quickly if it's about themselves. We could clearly see that currently Colin Kaepernick is really about the quest. It's not about him. He could have easily taken advantage of the notoriety that he's getting, but he's putting his money where his mouth is. He's single-handedly feeding starving children, using and hiring people on his own dime. So when you look at what these athletes are trying to say in totality, I don't think that they're necessarily thinking about themselves at all. They're thinking about the community. They're thinking about the people who came before them that were able to use this platform to make a change. So they're looking at it as strictly a change agent in a selfless way.
Joanne, to what Jimmy and just touched on and to what John was mentioning earlier, there's a serious message in all these protests, but there's a lot of noise around them. The president is sniping with the NFL or with individual players. There are criticisms from a lot of different corners, and then there's support from other corners. Do you feel like the message is getting lost in that noise as we get further and further away from the start of the issue?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just a microcosm of the society we live in right now, where every message is getting fragmented, torn, twisted, however you wish to articulate it. And, you know, to your first question about why, you know, is the NFL in trouble in terms of ratings and everything else, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who's a huge football fan, and he coalesced it really simply. He's like, there's just too much football on, and it's all kind of average. Nothing is special anymore. The NFL is everywhere. So you add that at a top layer, and then other people that are concerned about the protests. My dad's a Vietnam vet, and we just had this conversation 2 weeks ago that he went to a Veterans Day breakfast, was very proud to be with other veterans, and the message they had was, protest, do not go to a Lions game, do not watch an NFL game, make them pay. And I asked him, I said, but Dad, you fought in our military for the First Amendment. I mean, the thing that I do for a living as a journalist is the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court has already held that burning the American flag from the 1960s, from Vietnam, is protected speech. I think burning a flag is much more of a violent thing than, you know, standing, sitting, kneeling, whatever permutation for the anthem. And I'll go one more thing. I think we have so many sports in so many places that I think it's just like you don't need to make a choice to be with the NFL. If you want football, great. You can watch Michigan, you can watch Central, you can watch high school football. We're just awash in sports. So there's a lot of things confronting the NFL. But by the way, they're still making a lot of money. So I'm not going to start the funeral right now yet.
Well, Joanne, you and I were talking before we got started here, and the NFL has protests. We have not seen that spread as dramatically. But you were pointing out that there are ongoing protests in the WNBA. Could you explain a little bit about what's been going on there?
Well, I find this, I have this discussion. So one of my joys being a professor at Michigan State is talking with my students about the history of sports. Because unfortunately, you know, when you're 20 years old, your life is 5 minutes long. So your idea of what has happened in this world is 5 minutes long. And I was saying, you know, we had protests in the Mexico City Olympics. John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Billie Jean King took a stand for what she believed in. You move a little farther, WNBA. They wore hoodies before the men did for Trayvon Martin. They had hands up, don't shoot. The Minnesota Lynx. The best team in the WNBA for a while has been putting their names on it. Megan Rapinoe from the U.S. Women's Olympic soccer team took a knee in all the run-up for the Olympics. So this is not happening in a vacuum. This is just, interestingly, just pointed out at the NFL. And that's probably more of a sociological thing we can examine rather than an overall sports treatise.
I'd like to just go quickly down the line and ask each of you, will Colin Kaepernick ever play in the NFL again? Do you think he will, Jimmy?
No.
Maybe.
No, and it's a shame. There's no way. Have you seen half these teams?
Yeah.
You cannot say objectively he does not qualify as being one of the top 32 quarterbacks in the NFL. Not even close. And what you have here is the dichotomy. You said quickly, and I have failed.
The dichotomy I was expecting that.
Between billionaire owners and guys who often are from lesser means. And what I feel about Kaepernick and almost any African-American athlete is you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you don't stand up for those with less than you, then you're a sellout. You're selling out to Nike and all the rest. And if you stand up, you get basically attacked. So Kaepernick cannot win this situation the way it's set up. And the fact that every day that he's out is a day you can tell me that the NFL does not care about performance but about politics.
Well, and when you look over the list of NFL quarterbacks, not the starters who everybody's names, for the most part, are well-known, but you look at the bench, they're often these guys who have hung around the league and hung around the league. The idea that somebody who played in the Super Bowl, started successfully, isn't in the league seems like a real disconnect.
But, Doug, I still believe in the Cleveland Browns and their ability to need a quarterback. I still have a little bit of a hope. So I'm trying to be the optimist.
Here you go.
Kaepernick okay. might pass. I mean, I don't know. That. All right. I'd like to turn, you know, Colin Kaepernick is not getting paid now because of the situation around his situation. Another group of athletes that are not getting paid are NCAA athletes. I'd like to turn to that. And I'd like to start with the Adidas scandal, which is still unfolding. But for people who haven't been following that story, basically the FBI has accused a top man at Adidas Global Sports Marketing for paying the families of basketball players in the hopes that they would be recruited, to encourage them to be recruited and pulled into teams that wear Adidas in college. The long game being that then ideally these recruits will make it to the NBA and Adidas can sign them to a profitable endorsement deal to sell Adidas sneakers and sports gear. The list of schools that have been implicated, this is all still allegations, Louisville, Auburn, Arizona, Alabama, Oklahoma State, USC, South Carolina, Miami. So it's a wide-spreading investigation. Jimmy, what was your reaction when you heard about this? And in these two cases, the two young recruits, they're 14 or 15 years old, one family allegedly got $100,000, another family allegedly got $150,000. What was your reaction to that?
I was like, another Sunday, another day at the church. It wasn't nothing new under the sun. It's old scripture, right? It's the same thing. We've seen this a million times. And why does it keep happening? Obviously, the players need some assistance. We all know that everybody comes from different economic backgrounds. The problem has always been that you have a system where you have a multi-billion dollar company that runs and funds leagues. Therefore, how is it not going to cross over to the talent? The leagues don't transpire, the coaches don't happen without the players. the players aren't stupid. The families aren't stupid. They're looking to cash in somebody along the line, whether it's a mother or father, whether it's a friend or a cousin or somebody who just associated with them. So you have all of these people looking to clamor and to grab something off this guy. So until we just, you know, we open up and really discuss the true issues, that who cares about winning a basketball game when I could go home and I can't eat? So if I can take 10 grand from the Adidas guy, I'm going to take the 10 grand. So now my family could at least eat for a couple of months. So those are life choices. This is not about integrity as much as we like to make it. But every single one of us in here, if you haven't been hungry, you'd rather go outside and freeze to death than starve to death. I promise you that.
Jimmy, when you, on another sort of news note from a couple of years ago, you know, the NCAA has made some changes to try and cover some of those cost of life expenses that go along with it. Did that feel like a step in the right direction, or does that feel like a drop in the bucket of a much larger
problem? It's definitely in the step in the right direction. And the players get so much more amenities than we did. It's getting better every year. So as long as we keep having these discussions, as long as we keep talking about it, then eventually, in this sense, it gets better. I spoke with B-Line. He told me about some things and some things that the players get now. I was blown away. I was like, I didn't even know that. So it's getting better. I think as long as we keep the lines of discussion open, which we were kind of shot down for when we first stepped on the scene 25 years ago. People was like, just be happy you getting a free ride to college, shut up and go to school. But really, again, it's a slap in the face. It's like, oh, it's not a free education. We work for this. We're working. I'm in the gym 8 hours a day. That's work. So when I come home, I have to study and do my homework still, and then hopefully have a social life. So while my other counterparts can go to work and have other things that they can supplement for school, I can't do that. However, when I step on that court, the TV is paying you $2 million, but I can't get a cut of that. And that's just for today, though, for today's show. So we play 2-3 times a week. That was then. I don't know what the numbers are. But it's amazing to me that entity that's a nonprofit makes billions of dollars, don't open up their books, and don't want to pay their employees, because basically that's what they are.
And for a little perspective, when Jimmy was playing before the Fab Five took the court, I think the numbers for Michigan merchandising was in the neighborhood of like about $2 million. When the Fab Five hit the court and started getting national attention, it jumped to $10 million. That's in like 2 or 3 years.
Which is more.
That is more. And that number continued to skyrocket. And those, in today's dollars,
I don't know what that magic number is. I just know that if the players, the students feel, because it's, when you walk into a facility, you walk into this $60 million, $100 million, $200 million facility that's just built, and you're walking back and forth to school, and you don't have a car, you barely got a coat, got holes in your shoes, but you're helped building up this facility. You can't help but feel, not entitled, but feel like you earned something. So it's only fair that when you go from study table to your sport to practice, that you're fed well, that you at least are warm, that you have, you know, a standard of living. Because really, and if we really want to be honest about this, what that's teaching you is that when you become a CEO, that you can treat your employees like shit. So until we start talking about the real issue and coming up with some solutions, it's going to keep happening. But I do know that it's getting better. It's just that when it comes to, like, straight out paying an athlete on a collegiate amateur status, then that's when it starts transitioning over into what they say is you become a professional. However, I would love to have that conversation too, because if you're going to, if that's the case, then I'll be a little professional in college and you could just cut my $600,000 check and I'll pay for my school.
Mm-hmm. Doug, can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
I also want to bring in, you know, there is the misconception that anyone that plays collegiate athletics is there on a full ride. There's a lot of people that are competing on half rides, quarter rides, whatever. So they're going through everything that you went through, but they don't even have the benefit of their education being fully paid for. And I teach athletes all the time that are in other, you know, non, you know, as we politically put it, the Olympic sports. So the soccers, the cross countries, the rowings, you know, things that you cannot necessarily go professional in. They're wrecked. I mean, they're exhausted. They're practicing. They're going to school. They can't go get another job waitressing or Ubering or delivering for insomnia cookies or whatever. I mean, that's what it is. So the situation you had, as crappy as it was the best you could get. There were people that had much lower deals. And especially when you get into women's athletics, oh, well, the women don't make any money, so be happy that you're here. So it's a much more complicated mess than just, you know, there's a lot of people suffering out there. And I worry about the athletes when I see that they're bruised and battered and exhausted, and then, God forbid, they get a season-ending injury and they can't come back. Bye-bye. Your health care is gone. I mean, you're almost like excommunicated from the family. And I don't want to be dramatic about it, but either you're in or you're out. And so there's a lot more nuance to this situation. And for people like him, I'm a former college athlete. I played tennis. I mean, I wore baggy shorts too, but I didn't look as good as you did. But my point is, there's a lot of nuances to this situation that are way more than just do we pay, not pay.
And I think that's a point that's in casual conversation, a surprising for a lot of people, is the athletes who get hurt, suddenly they don't have a scholarship anymore, and suddenly the college is done with them. And that happens. It's not a guaranteed thing that carries you all the way through. John, you had something to add?
Sure. What Jimmy and Joanne said is exactly right. It's a full-time job, whether the NCAA admits it or not. They count 20 hours, but you have to spend 40 hours to count that 20. Basically, it's like a legal billing, essentially. You work 100 hours to bill 50. And I learned this the hard way in 2009, a very dumb idea I had. Denard Robinson, I was following the team around for 3 years for three and out. And Denard and I became pretty close. He called me the Baconator. That was his favorite meal.
I think they serve that at Zingerman's.
At Wendy's they do, actually, and that was his favorite meal. And he says, you got to do everything we're doing. I said, I already am, man. I'm following you guys to class. I'm following you guys to the weight room and you name it. He goes, no, you got to do it. Yeah. This is when stupid me said, okay. And I signed up for this very bad idea, 6 weeks in the Michigan football weight room. I could not walk out of there on the first day. And I was in better shape then than I am now by far. For a week and a half, I went through what's called hypertrophy, where you can barely walk. When you take your shower afterwards, you can't raise your arms. You take the shampoo and you like shoot it in the air and hope some of it hits your head. Because you ain't lifting your arms, man. And you just turn the water on hotter. And I went back and whimpered on the couch. You cannot sleep, you're in too much pain. I whimpered on the couch for about an hour and a half. And when I got off that couch, I realized the guys I lifted weights with have just finished their second class of the morning. So if anybody out there thinks for a second this is a free ride, follow Denard around for one day and see how exhausted you are at the end of that. It's a 16-hour day at least. Of course, they're not paid anything. The day ends with Denard walking out of the football building at 11 o'clock at night. There are five guys there with glossy photos of Denard Robinson they want to have signed, 10 each for their 10 kids apparently. And I went home, and half an hour later, I saw them all on eBay. Yeah. So he made not a dollar out of that, and they made all this. Now, scholarships for real, out of state, they pay retail in athletics. The checkup goes up the hill, $20 million. That's not to be sneezed at. But what Jimmy and Joanne said is exactly right, that right now there's no negotiating power. There's no choice. And that's for two reasons. One is, unlike hockey and baseball, we've had viable minor leagues for 100 years. There are no minor leagues in basketball. There are no minor leagues in football. They've got you. You're trapped. And now you've got a one-and-done situation in college where whether you want to play in college or not, you're going. And those guys go to Kentucky, by the way. So they don't graduate the way they do it in Beeline's program. So you're trapped, essentially. So they don't have the and if you don't want to be, if you're a hotshot baseball or hockey player and you don't want to play college athletics, you don't want to be a student, you want to get paid, go right ahead. I had one of my students at Michigan who plays hockey at Michigan, got sick of it. Now he played for the Plymouth Whalers and got a $250,000 advance. If that's what you want, go ahead. You have that choice. You're trapped in college. And the reason now all these emoluments are coming to these players that Jimmy talked about, these benefits here and there, it's not because the NCAA finally found religion and is going noblesse oblige. They are terrified of the student athletes standing up for themselves and saying to hell with the whole thing. And a few years ago, Taylor Branch did a great article for the Atlantic magazine. We talked to the UNC chancellor, the president of the university system down there, and I don't know what team it was, and Taylor didn't tell me either, but there's a team in the top 10 about 8 or 9 years ago that vowed to each other that if they got to the Final Four in the NCAA basketball tournament and they had a real chance, they're going to, after their names are announced, they're going to sit down and not play. And then what does CBS do? Live TV, and the guys are sitting down. The athletes have no power until they sit down, and then they've got all of it. And one of these days, that's exactly what's going to happen.
So Adidas has put itself in this position where they're being investigated. Again, these are allegations. They haven't been proven. It hasn't played its full way out. But Adidas has approximately 2 or 3% of the basketball sneaker market. Nike has more than 90% of the basketball sneaker market. So Adidas is willing to spend, again, allegedly, $250,000 on teenagers who aren't even out of high school yet to increase their 2 to 3% share of the market. I think that lends some perspective to how huge the global sort of athletic wear industry is. And that led to some crossover for these first two topics for you guys, Jimmy, right? You had the protests and the incentivizing of the gear that you were wearing. You guys went to shirts with no logos and just plain blue shirts when you came out for warm-ups.
When we were here in Michigan and we went through the process of the negotiating process, really, with Nike. I remember going on the road. I can't remember where it was. I want to say Penn State. And it may not have been Penn State. But we came back. It was got Metro Airport. It was about 1:30, 2 in the morning. And we were driving back on 94. And, I mean, we got off 94, hit State Street. And, you know, back in those days, it was dark. You could go straight down. It was pitch black. You know, hardly any lights going down State Street going on the campus. So I remember, you know, the bus, you know, when it slows down, it starts jiggling a little bit and vibrating a little bit. So I woke up and I remember these bright lights and I was like, where are we? You know, I'm thinking, well, we still at the airport, where are we at? And we were on campus right at Schembechler Hall, and they had put this giant Nike sign. Like, today, that's nothing. Today, we see all these giant screens, digital screens. But in 91, 92, it was a giant, like, the size of the big house screen. And I'm like, where are we? And on the bottom of it was a giant Nike sign. And so, you know, the next morning we get up, go to practice, and Nike is there, and so we're asking questions like, what's, you know, like, oh, okay, so there's money being passed here. Oh, cool. So where do we play in this? And that's when we found out that it's really, I mean, obviously, you know, it's this is big business, and you guys are just a part of the little peon shuffle. So for us, we were like, oh, you just can't bury us like that. So while we helped build somewhat of your market that you're going to push Nike, because honestly, if any of you looked at the Huarache shoe, that is not a basketball shoe. There is no ankle support in that. So the reason why we chose it is because that if they push that as a basketball shoe, we know that that's our shoe. So when they push that shoe, we were like, oh, we got a shoe. So let's come back to the drawing board. We need to have a meeting with Nike. They reluctantly set it up, of course. Walked into the room. And they sit across the table. They're like, what's going on? The gear is okay. We look good. Everything is fine. Everything's comfortable. We're fly. We're fresh. However, we feel like, you know, we're not being compensated. And we understand that we are in college, and we understand that we are amateur athletes. We understand the rules, all of this. However, I think in this situation it's a little different because what we are unpaid consultants to you. So we may be able to now change the future and how the business is done and for people who are in our position to be able to be compensated. You don't have to be compensated in the college. We could do a stipend. We could do, you know, we could work a, some other kind of business deal out, something. They didn't even want to hear it. They pushed from the table, stood up, and walked out. So our protest was, okay, you don't want to hear us. We're not hearing you. We're not going to wear anything that wears that says Nike on it. We're just going to wear a blank T-shirt. So that was our protest for us when when we came across that situation.
Incredibly, my students who were not born when Mr. King was playing at Michigan, they still recall, they know about the blue shirt incident. Mm-hmm. To put the economics into some kind of perspective, because these are big numbers and they're flying around and so on, when Michigan was making $10 million off merchandise during the Fab Five era, the budget for the entire department was around $40 or $50 million. So that represents about 20, 25% of the overall budget is Fab Five jerseys. So that's the impact that it made on Michigan at that time. The kind of money that the NCAA makes on March Madness, last time I checked was in 2013, was $1 billion for the TV ad revenue alone for 3 weekends of basketball, $1 billion for that, just that chunk right there. That's about 98% of the NCAA's budget. Hockey chips in a little bit, and that's about all, basically. So that's where the money comes from. Now they got the playoff as well. And, of course, from that, you've got $1 million president, Mark Emmert, running a nonprofit. How a nonprofit has $1 million president of anything, be it Red Cross or anything else, I don't understand that. And last thing about the economics. When Bo Schembechler came here to Michigan, Don, he took the job without knowing what he's going to get paid. And that does not happen now. I can guarantee that he had no agent or anything like that. He went down to Oxford, Ohio, and his wife asked him the very wise question, so what are you getting paid? And he thought, forgot to ask. So maybe that would be a good question. So he called.
He
Don
just
Kim.
Texted them and
of course.
Sorted
and
it out.
Looked online at the various rates.
Good job, Millie.
Yeah, 68 we're talking about there. Good job, Millie. So he calls up Don Canham rather sheepishly and asks, you know, by the way, we didn't discuss pay. Any idea what that might be? And Canham says, also reverse negotiating, what are you getting paid at Miami right now? And Bo says, well, $19,000, but it's going to be $20,000 next year. And Canham said, okay, we'll make it $21,000. Those are not numbers on a contract anymore. It's X point X million is what you're getting paid as a defensive coordinator, as an offensive coordinator. So the money has skyrocketed for the coaches since 1986 to the present. Coaching salaries across the NCAA, not just the big names like Izzo and Harbaugh and so on, but across the NCAA have gone up more than 800% in real dollars, not inflationary dollars. Meanwhile, faculty pay is level, and there are fewer faculty members because now they're adjuncts like me and not Joanne. She's tenured. So that's how much it's changed, and of course, the student-athlete pay has not changed at all. So when you look at this house of mirrors of the finances, you realize just how crazy the whole thing really is.
And just so you understand the lay of the land, Big Ten Network did not exist, so that is a venture between the Big Ten universities and Fox. ESPN annually shows 4,000 games. That's their inventory across the board from ESPN, the Deuce, and the U, and the online. So it's just, you know, do the math in your head. It's almost like a tote board that she just keeps spinning. And then throw in, too, is that we also have women's basketball that's being shown, the women's Final Four, all that stuff. That's pretty profitable, enough that they keep investing in it. So the money game, I mean, the money probably that you guys would have settled for now would not even be get out of bed money. I mean, it's just the economy of scale has radically changed.
So one of the long-term, you know, the issues of caring for athletes is the cost of attending college and whether or not they should be paid. Another long-term issue is their health after the injuries that they incur during playing time. I want to turn to you again, Joanne. Joanne wrote a book about concussions and the information that's out there about them. And you and your co-author make the case that there's a lot of misinformation and that there are, of course, real risks. Share some of the key points that led you to the finding that there's a swell of misinformation out there about concussions.
Well, it's the brain, the most complex part of your body. So we're all individuals. All four of us could run right now into that mirror. I might be fine. You might be dazed. You would be unconscious, given what you just told us from the weight room.
Sounds about right.
And we'll make Doug okay. But I'm just saying, though, we all...
I'd be running slower into it.
Okay, and we'll put a helmet on you. But I'm just saying that we're four human beings, you know, the same organic chemistry, but our brains are very different in how we respond. And did someone have ADHD? Did someone have depression? Did someone have existing issues, you know, like you incurred a whiplash, you know, a neck injury? So this is not a yes or no, red light, green light, your arm is broken, your arm is not broken. It's very individualized. Every concussion is unique. The joke is, if you've seen one concussion, you've seen one concussion. So every single one needs to be treated seriously. And, you know, you mentioned Bo. I mean, I talked to a lot of guys that played for Bo, and this was the era, no slam on Bo, but it's like, you know, get up, be a man, shake it off. I mean, you probably heard that too. Oh, you're just dazed, you know, keep going. Well, guess what? When you're dazed, it's your brain's way of saying, hey, hello, you might want to stop playing and get me checked out. And thankfully, the evolution we've had in our society in the last 5-10 years is that we really are much more willing to admit that athletes can get hurt, have infrastructure. I mean, you saw what happened on Saturday at Wisconsin. You know, Michigan's quarterback didn't keep playing. He was unconscious. We didn't put him back in. Back in the day, we'd have given him smelling salts and told him to get his butt back in there with a couple choice words. So we've evolved. But here's the thing. It's not just your head. You know, I know we both know a lot of people that played in college. Their shoulders are jacked up. Their knees are jacked up. You know, I'm a college tennis player. I've had my ACL done. I mean, thank God I'm okay. But, I mean, there's a real cost to repetitive use injuries. And then when you're playing a violent sport, there's other things that happen. So we need to take this incredibly seriously, but not so far over the edge that we declare every person that has a concussion to be somewhat of a scarlet red letter. Because every person that has a concussion, it lasts for 7 to 10 days, and then they heal. What happens afterwards is a totally different clinical condition called post-concussive syndrome. And some people have it, some people don't. But guess what? It's medically treatable. It's medically treatable. So having an infrastructure where there are athletic trainers who are certified, where there are sports neurologists, where athletes feel empowered to admit that they're hurt and not lose their scholarship or their spot, those are all in play. So we're getting better, but we have a long way to go.
Well, and the fact that we now, in reporting, in sports stories, you say, you know, Brandon Peters has entered the concussion protocol, and we all know what that is. That was not the case 10 years ago. John, in a commentary on Michigan Radio last week, you talked about concussions, and one of your points was that perception may be one of the most powerful things in shaping the future of the game of football in particular. Can you share a little bit about that and how, regardless of the realities, it's that perception among parents that's going to be a big factor for where we are in a generation, right?
Oh, exactly right. And, of course, for that, I studied what? Joanne's book, which I recommend highly. Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher is her co-author, and I talked to him about this as well. She did a great job on this. My theory on this is, and she's, of course, exactly right across the board. I played high school hockey for Huron. People say, did you play high school hockey? I was on the team. Big difference. This man played. I was, every day
we're all
I
the same.
Up is what I did.
1 through 15, we're all the same.
There you go. 1 through 15. That's a team attitude right there. Nonetheless, I managed to go through 3 helmets in 3 years on the team. I was the smallest guy in the league for 3 years. It's not a good thing to be. And I, more than once, you know, how many hands am I holding up? And that was close enough. Man, you went to the bench. And you took some water, and you got back out there. So that, and we had good trainers. I mean, but people didn't know. That was the thing there. The problem with the games right now is the generation you see aging right now in the 50s and 60s will likely be, in my opinion, and I bet yours also, the most damaged generation we're going to see. These guys had two-a-day practices way back when in college and pro and high school. All right, they when you got hit, they said, suck it up, cobwebs, get back in the game, got your bell rung, you laugh it off and so on. They played on AstroTurf, which is a quarter inch of plastic on top of concrete. So this generation will probably be the most damaged we ever see, and right now they're aging. So I can guarantee you, the generation you see coming up now will be much less damaged than the ones you see now. But here's the catch, back to your point, is the safety of the sport, not just football. It turns out that soccer and basketball aren't that far behind from your book.
Cheerleading is worse.
Cheerleading.
Cheerleading's number one. I don't hear anyone going to the mat to save the cheerleaders. It's the stunting cheerleaders, no equipment, no trainers, and usually a mat that big. So when we talk about concussions, we need to evaluate divers, gymnasts. Think about what we're really talking about. I'd rather play football. Seriously. I have a helmet, I have a trainer, and I probably have grass.
That's right. And you can come off the field and you're good to go. So it's not only a matter of making the sport safer, especially football, which gets all the attention. It's convincing parents that it is safer. If they make it 10 times safer and you're good to go, and it's safer than cheerleading, safer than soccer. If mom and dad don't believe this, then junior's not playing football. If junior's not playing football, teams collapse. In the state of Missouri alone this year, 24 high schools have cut football. That's Missouri, man. That's not Connecticut. That's the heart and soul, the breadbasket, hardcore SEC country and so on, and they're cutting football. If a critical mass of teams fold, whether you want to play football or not, you won't have a team to play for and teams to play against. So the bigger battle right now is the PR battle, and the NFL is handling it almost exactly wrong, in my opinion.
Jimmy, you've done a lot of work with kids and young athletes. Do you see a change among parents and coaches and how they approach injuries from when, say, we were growing up and when you were playing as a kid?
I do. For the past two or three years, I've seen the discussion of CTE and concussions, being the forefront. I've had a lot of parents approach me, ask me about my opinion about the game. My personal opinion is that it's just like John said, it's, and we have to be conscious of what it is that we're putting ourselves into or we're putting our kids into. My son, who's 14 now, wanted to play football. I told him it's his decision. However, I did say that I have a concern with you playing football or what's going on now. So the discussions that I have with parents have been a high level of concern, but if the kid has a desire to play, they're allowing their kids to play. And I've only met a few parents that are totally keeping their kids out of the sport altogether just because of the reports on CTE. So there is a little dip. Or at least concern when it comes to the kids playing football, but I don't think it's that major of a issue. But if they're losing 25 programs in Missouri, the heartland, then maybe that's something that we really should be looking to.
But I think there's a little more nuance to this than maybe we're bringing out. I think this is a socioeconomic issue that the teams that I'm worried about in high school are not the kids at Pioneer, not the kids at Huron, because they have, a good community with good, stable tax base. It's the kids that live in areas that are under economic stress where they can't afford a new $400 football helmet each year, where maybe they don't have the money and the resources to have a full-time athletic trainer on staff for their high school. Less than half of our high schools in this country have a full-time athletic trainer on staff. That should be non-negotiable, that you have the safeguard to help an athlete when they're hurt. And even the schools that do have the economic means to fund trainers, can you imagine if you're the one person who's a trainer, say, at Troy Athens High School, and you have the football team there, the soccer team there, the swimming and diving team over there, the cheerleading teams over there, and oh, by the way, there's some JV people doing something over there. You can't be everywhere. And this fear, I mean, I've my book came out last year at this time, and I've done a ton of speaking to parents around the state, around the country. And the one thing that makes me laugh, internally obviously, is it's usually a mom that comes up to me, and with a little bit of a lilt, I will not let my son play football. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. It's a personal choice. What does your son do? Oh, he plays lacrosse.
Problem solved. Boom.
Right.
So, like, wait a second. What are we worried about here? So we're not looking at the facts for what they are. I've had parents come up to me saying, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad I have a daughter. Oh, well, that's great. Yay, team girls. But why are you – what's with the daughter? Oh, my daughter plays basketball. She'll never get a concussion. Are you kidding me?
Sir?
You seen rebounding?
She probably had two that day.
That's my point. So this is to me sometimes the fallacy of the discussion with football. If you have a brain, you can have a concussion. It doesn't matter the age. It doesn't matter the level. But having the intelligence to look at the facts, make sure that your school where your child attends has safeguards, like, you know, the right equipment, the right coaching. By the way, if you notice, NFL Films is no longer showing those montages set to classical music where people are killing each other, or the NHL is not putting out the Rock'em Sock'em Don Cherry beat you down videos. We've evolved. So are things going to be perfect? No. But here's the thing. People ask me all the time, well, do you see the end of football? Okay, so what are you going to do with the Big House? What are you going to do with Ford Field? What are you doing with Spartan Stadium? And oh, by the way, there's an awfully big stadium at Penn State. I don't see football going away. I don't see it for everybody, but it never has been for everybody. Make a smart decision, but make it based on science and the facts and not extreme things of that you find on the internet.
And this is where the NFL has done a much better job with the safety. NCAA certainly has. The high school has as well. The high schools have as well. So that, as we said, the reality, the science of it. But NFL has done a horrible job on the PR. And they're always trying to cover up the stupid stuff and push that off, and so on. If they just tell the story, they'll be a whole lot better off. They're in danger of being part of the anti-vaccination movement, basically. That once that's out there, it is very hard to roll that back. And now you're out there 10, 15 years trying to get the science out there and so on. And I revert back to my old buddy Don Canham, the old AD at Michigan, who had the best line on PR I've ever heard: never turn a one-day story into a two-day story. And that involves eating the one-day story. And the NFL cannot take any bruises whatsoever. No one, from Tom Brady's Deflategate to all the rest, is better at turning a one-day story into a two-day story than the NFL.
We're going to take some questions from the audience. So if you have a question, could you raise your hand, and Lindsay will get around the room here to get a microphone to you.
Greg, right. Stay skill of the FBI. I know you. Don't ask why.
You've talked about different, you know, debates about compensation for student athletes, and how obviously there's no perfect solution, otherwise it would be in use right now, but how do you determine what somebody is worth? I mean, in the professional level, the U.S. women's national soccer team earns what the men's team does for a loss when they win, and they're, you know, the best team in the world. So, you know, how do you determine what's the process that should happen to say, well, this is what Garrett Moores, the placeholder, gets, and this is what, you know, Mo Hurst gets for his value to the university and to the NCAA?
I don't think you look at it individually. I think you look at it as a team. It's like a media group. You have a bunch of investors or owners who own one thing. You may have a point man. You may have someone who's behind the scenes. But the point man may seem more valuable just because he's in the eye, but the guy behind the scenes may actually be more valuable because of what he brings intrinsically to the team, what he does behind the scenes that elevates the team. So when you're looking at it, in my opinion, individually, that's hard to do. I think you look at what they're making. That's number one. Have you ever seen what they're making? No, you have not. Until we do, we cannot determine that. That's why I always kill that. I'm like, well, until they open up the books, we can't determine, because we could shoot ourselves in the foot. They would love for us to name a number. They really would. Well, because you got, because you, I mean, you know, in 3 weeks, they're making $1 billion. Right. So in 3 weeks, am I worth 100 million? 10,000? Like, what is it? So if they're able to open up the books, then we'll be able to determine what the worth is. Until then, we can't. All we can say is, all I say is okay, if that's the dilemma, well, then cut me my check for the scholarship that I would be paying for my 4 years, plus expenses, plus books, plus blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, and then we could sit down and come out and hammer out a number, but we can't just arbitrarily do it without a hard number.
And let me flip the script for a second from the female athlete side. Okay, I'm never going to the NBA. I play college tennis. I was never going to be in Wimbledon. The moment I stepped at 14 years old onto a college, into a high school team in the state of Michigan, you know, I'm not going to be pro. That's cool. I mean, my life is good. So when you talk about paying people, your net worth as an athlete walking into the University of Michigan was a hell of a lot bigger than mine when I walked in at Oakland University. We both worked our butts off. We both, you know, did what we had to do. But the point is, how do you make it equal? And then the NCAA side is, oh, well, you know, that's why you can't pay everyone, because it's too complicated and we can't figure this out. But ultimately comes back to is, well, okay, so you were really good against Carolina. You played awesome. But you sucked against Penn State. You know, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics. But the bigger thing that's interesting is if you look into the history of the NCAA, and the NCAA actually does figure into my book, because the NCAA was actually started as a precursor because people were dying on the field playing football, like cracking heads open back in the days in the 1920s. Teddy Roosevelt got everyone together like, yo, people, let's figure this out. So the forum of the NCAA came, and they basically got together, and as a term of art, this guy started the term student-athlete. That was like the bulletproof, hey, they're student-athletes. Started this whole new, basically, division of labor law, and if you want to look into it, it'll like make your eyes bleed, but it's very good to know. So when he comes and says, hey, cut me a check for my scholarship, when I say, hey, I got to pay for books on top of what I'm doing, and my books cost $600 a semester, and as we all know, you sell them back for $2.50, where's my check? The NCAA says, oh, but you're a student athlete. Aren't you happy to be a student athlete? So all hail Northwestern University. The athletes there might be the ones that are going to crack this nut. The football players got together. They're going through the National Labor Relations Board, and they're trying to get this step by step. But the NCAA is a cabal. There's no other way around it. It is a cabal because it makes tons of money, but then pretends it's a nonprofit. Trust me, if you go to Indianapolis and see their super shiny, amazing building, that's a hell of a nonprofit. So show us the money.
That's right. All true, of course. On the 1905, by the way, 18 football players died on the fields of football programs, high school and college. Mm-hmm. So imagine 18 guys dying doing anything these days, and how quickly whatever that is would be shut down. That's what started the NCAA. So nothing new under the sun, as Jimmy King said early on in this conversation. As far as what's next, how to compensate, it is undeniably complicated, et cetera, and yet they compensate coaches, so they figure out a way to do that. Mm-hmm. The overriding factor here, however, is Title IX, and almost no one talks about that when discussing this. Yep. Title IX is virtually undefeated in the courtrooms. Most of those court cases take about 30 seconds for the judge to grab the gavel. The whole thing's one paragraph. Mm-hmm. And it's an educational act. It's not an athletic act. It's about educational opportunity. If you pay the starting quarterback $5,000 under the current law, you've got to pay the backup women's coxswain on the second crew team. She gets $5,000 also, or else the law breaks down. So that's not going to work that way. I go back to the simple idea that you need a minor league. And it's the Bacon Unifying Theory of all sports, by the way, in case you're doing this at home. I look forward to my royalties on that, of course. If you don't have what you have in baseball and hockey, until you have minor leagues in football and basketball, you will never get a fair system going for either football or basketball. You're going to be trapped. That's all there is to it.
Do we have another question? I can't see Lindsay. But
there she is. Hi. So a very small percentage of NCAA athletes wind up in the professional ranks. We've discussed compensation for them while they're NCAA athletes, but I think Aaron Hernandez has provided a demonstration that damage, long-term damage, occurs much earlier than has long been thought. What are your thoughts on responsibility from the NCAA in the long-term effects from participation in sports?
I'll go first, and Joanne, I'm sure, will pick up this up, and so will Jimmy. That is the very easy thing to negotiate. Title IX aside and compensation aside, there's no reason you can give me why a university should not be responsible for the lifelong health care of somebody who played sports at your university during those 4 years, whether it's a knee you got to replace when you're 55 years old, or CTE, et cetera, Hernandez included. That's something you can negotiate for right now and should get immediately.
Because healthcare negotiations always go really smoothly.
That's right. Who knew it was so complicated, right? But that to me is a, pardon the expression, in this case, a no-brainer. And one that, and by the way, these universities, the whole point of these universities is to improve the lives of the men and women who go there. You can't give me the argument, as the founding of the University of Michigan 200 years ago, that it's okay for us to have you come to this university, get damaged playing for that university, and be out of your luck when you're 50 or 60 years old, and we don't have any responsibility whatsoever. That, to me, is criminal.
And I want to address Aaron Hernandez. Obviously, he lived a very troubled life. And we only know, now that he's dead and we have his brain, what was going on in his brain. But I can't tell you when his brain got to be when it was. So the causality, and it's actually said in the fourth paragraph of the study on him, that they cannot find any direct causality between playing football and CTE. Because we have a lot of other things going on. I'm not saying that playing football made his life better. Look, blows to the head are never good. Just laying that down. I know that's massive science, but don't hit your head. But we also have mental illness. And we have players that we, frankly, leave them play crazy. I mean, we can look at Ron Artest. We can look at Mike Tyson. We can look at some other things that they walked in with some rage issues and some ticking time bombs that actually playing sports kind of kept them on the rails because they had an outlet for their rage. They had a place that was organized, almost like a family, a team, to keep them straight. And, you know, I know Eric Hipple really well. He played for the Lions, and he knew since he was an early teenager that he had suicidal thoughts. He knew he had depression. And the one thing that kept him on the rails was playing football. He enjoyed the contact. He enjoyed it. So then when his life got further away from football, that's when things started really falling apart. So when do you mark the moment, and this will be the legal argument that the NFL or other places will say, we don't know the moment that your concussion issues or whatever things are going on in your life cross over into something else. We're not there yet in science. So you're not going to be able to prove in court that Aaron Hernandez had CTE because he played football. Now, obviously, if I'm suing the NFL for his contract, I'm going to try. But in terms of pure empirical science, where we are, we can't do that.
Jimmy, I want to ask you a follow-up question on that. How did healthcare change for you when it wasn't about your athletic career anymore? When suddenly you're going to a doctor because you're Jimmy King and you're going to the doctor and you need to go to the doctor, but it's not about getting you back on the court as quickly as possible. Was that a noticeable change for you after your playing days ended?
Unfortunately, no, because you're conditioned at that point to overlook a lot of ailments. We're conditioned to, when something hurts, it's not that bad.
Not worth mentioning.
Yeah, it's not. Nah, don't mention if it's not if it's not going to stop you from going to work today. Mm-hmm. You could get through it. So that causes a lot of issues down the road. And I'm currently going through something. You know, right now I have to go to L.A. For workers' comp through the NBA. Just because I'm 90, there's a percentage that they use when they look at your skeletal. And I know I'm sure y'all, you know, familiar with this. They look at your, you know, I don't even know what it's called, but they do a scan of your body, look at your bones, look at your muscles, they look at your ligaments, all of that, right? Okay. They do a full body scan, they do an evaluation on the totality of your body. So if you have some arthritis or ligament damage or synovial fluid or something missing or something like that, they put a percentage over your overall health. And I was like at the worst. Right? Right. And I'm looking at them like, wow. You know, and they're like, yeah, you're pretty bad. Like as you get older, it's going to get worse.
Oh, good.
Right. So I'm like, so we have issues that we don't know about. And if I wasn't fortunate enough to be in a position to afford that, I wouldn't know. And then one day it could just, something could just, yeah, it could just happen. I could just wake up and then a speculation about, you know, did he pick it up afterwards or doing, but really as athletes and most of us, it's not athletes, have injuries every day. We have normal wear and tear on our bodies. We go see our doctors. They tell us this all the time. As an athlete, you progress it by 20, 30 years. That's why we see football players passing at 45, 48, 50 years old. So for healthcare for me, it changed in the sense that we now look at the bills versus the team paying for it. And that's the biggest difference. We have families, so we pay for the kids and everything. We look at, obviously, you know, we're more frugal in that sense. But when it comes to going to the doctor, doing checkups and stuff like that, we usually fall back to the principle of, I'm all right, I'll be all right. You know, it's just a little something, yeah.
All right, let's take another question.
Thanks. Hi, thank you very much. My name is Michelle, and this has been so informative and so interesting. My brother's a football coach, college, and he's been in divisions 1, 2, and 3, and he's in a division 3 school now. And I would just like to, I told him I was coming to this, and I'd like to tell him what he said, what can he say to parents and to his student athletes about, there's so much value in the game. I have learned so much over the years from him about what there is in this game that you guys all know this, the teamwork and the passion and achievement and all of that. What does he say to his students and their families about the potential risks versus the very real advantages?
John, you want to start with that?
Or Joanne, please.
I think the very act of what you're doing is having the discussion is the power, because we need to talk about it. This whole, we've got the two extremes. Oh, my gosh, you know, this generation, they're such wusses. They're all getting concussions. It doesn't exist. Too, I played football, and I was hurt 8 times, and I kept playing. We need to veer it back to the middle. Sports is one of the most amazing parts of my life. It helped give me confidence. It helped teach me how to win and lose. It taught me how to, you know, get through things that maybe I didn't want to get through. And I don't shy away, though. You can get hurt. Bad things can happen. But what you say is, when bad things happen to any parts of our body, we have an action plan. This is what's going to happen. We have this trainer, or we have a mom that is a nurse, or you know, or a dad who's a nurse, or a doctor, or somebody. We have people in place, and we have given this thought. And furthermore, in terms of concussion, that if you are diagnosed with a concussion, you know who to go see in your community. God bless pediatricians. They're amazing people. But for a lot of them, they do not have comprehensive neurological training to deal with kids that are playing sports. So go see a sports neurologist. Go see somebody that knows. But if your coach, if your school, if your league cannot answer the simple question of, hey, if my kid gets hurt of any stripe, but especially concussion, what are you going to do? This is not like an attack, like, oh, I'm here at the FBI. It's like, what are you going to do? And then when a child is hurt, you need to empower them to say, hey, guess what? I don't feel right. Or my teammate Jimmy, he doesn't look right. None of this snitches get stitches and all this crazy stuff we built into sports. We take care of each other because on the field we're teammates. And I tell you, parents also need to be smart in saying, if a child is hurt or a player is hurt, and I don't care if it's the state final next Friday at Ford Field, when he comes out, he stays out. You don't go after the referee. You don't go after the coach and say, but hey, Michigan's here to recruit my kid. You got to put him back in. We respect the injury, but we talk about it, have a plan. And if you see a coach that's not playing right, that they're looking too rough, or they're not doing the equipment right, get out. Get out. Get another coach, get another league. But understand the sport is an amazingly beautiful, empowering experience for your child. And guess what? Most of us don't make it to the pros. Most of us don't make it to college. But we still find value in discovering who we are. And I'm all on team average, man. You know, have fun. Be average. Be cool. And
are
you know
talking
what?
About John and I?
I don't want to call
average.
John. I've already heard his feelings. But my point is, your very question is what needs to happen in every school, every club at the Y. By talking about it and being informed about the facts, which is why I wrote the book, is the power. That's how we get people better medical care, but also better outcomes as being athletes. We feel empowered.
My answer to that question, and I'm a fervent believer in scholastic sports especially, not just travel teams, but those sports that are attached to a school, in high school and college and so on. First of all, as I said earlier, the sports are, and she knows better than I do, are much, much safer now than they were even 10 years ago. It's not even close. And your brother, I'm sure, can speak to that. So that's one thing right there. Let's get that out there. Second of all, Title IX is the Educational Amendments Act of 1973, I believe it was, or 72. Let me repeat that. The Educational Amendments Act. It's a paragraph long. Not anywhere in there is there the word athletics anywhere in that paragraph. And yet, we've applied it to athletics as well as other things because of a simple belief that goes back 100 years, and Fielding Yost espoused this, and I believe this. These sports can teach you things properly coached. The classroom never will. And in the classroom, by the way, it's every man or woman for themselves. You decide how good your grade wants to be, you know, how hard you want to work, and so on. On a team, you don't have that option. And I believe the real world far more closely resembles a team environment than it does the classroom. And that is why, by the way, when people have a chance of hiring, I used to joke about this, my 3.4 history pre-unemployment, thank you very much, major, I am hockey king, versus Ryan Van Bergen, 2.9, starting defensive end, hire him. That guy works 40 hours a week plus whatever I do. He gets up at 6 a.m. He can handle criticism. He knows what it is to be a part of a team, handle setbacks, all these things. Look at these guys. And the Fab Five has done phenomenally well outside of basketball. All of them have. And that's instructive. Bruce Mahdi, a mutual friend of all of ours, gave me a great line. He said, the best ambassadors for Michigan athletics are Michigan's athletes. And if you don't believe in them, go meet them and go to the reunions at 20, 30 years out and ask them what their neighbors are doing, from the neighbors they're from and so on, the towns they're from and whatnot. Almost to a man or woman, they've done much better than their peers have from their high schools. And a big part of that is college athletics. So I believe in this fervently, to say the least. And I know that I got Mike Alber out there, old high school buddy. Albers, I see you, pal. He can vouch for the fact that I rode the Pines for 3 years at Ann Arbor Huron High School. I still hold the record. Most games in Huron uniform, 86. The fewest goals, 0. And no one has ever broken my record. It is, in fact, a family record, I have to tell you. My brother's also on the team. He also failed to score a goal during his time on the team. He likes to point out that he played goalie. Nonetheless, everyone's got excuses. So my point is this. From the worst possible high school career, I cannot tell you how many doors playing high school hockey at the lowest possible level has done for me. I got my job at the Ann Arbor News because the editor played hockey at Pioneer. I got my job at the Detroit News because they're playing the Detroit Free Press every year in the Lafayette Cup, and they sucked. They needed a ringer. I qualified for them as a ringer. Things built from there. When I talk to a coach, I have played high school sports. That means something. You have too. It means something. For that piddlesome experience, it's opened so many doors I can't tell you. So please assure them that school athletics are far more plus than negative, not even close.
And John's message is don't study, just play. That's
exactly. It worked for me.
And don't get him on your hockey team. He's brutal. Come on.
We got a lot of questions, so I want to make sure we get to some more. Lindsay, can we get another question?
I'd like to build on something Joanne said. Joanne, you said that if you've got a bad coach, if they've got bad equipment, if they're not being treated right, they should move on. More so than even in colleges where someone can leave a program and sit out for a year and then play again, high school athletes don't have that option in many cases. They are absolutely stuck with their program unless they can afford to go from Ypsilanti to Detroit Catholic Central or something like that and pay the tuition. So, and this builds on something John said as well. Is there any chance that we can disentangle athletics from schools in this country? Because we are unique in that regard. I've served in the Army for 25 years, and around the world, nobody does it like this. And I'm wondering what the possibilities are of disentangling that, because that would solve, it seems to me, a lot of problems that we're seeing here.
And that's
Thank you.
And that's exactly the crux of the issue. What you said is way too logical, so it will never happen. And especially think about smaller towns, you know, the whole Friday Night Lights thing. You want to disentangle Fenton High School, you know, for example, from their football team when the whole town is there? No. But in terms of what you're saying with a bad coach, yeah, absolutely there's bad coaches. I think we've all had some people that we knew probably should not have been in front of us, but we were kids. We didn't have power. And I'm definitely not advocating being the maniac parent that's, you know, starting the Fire Coach Smith website, which, by the way, I'm now finding out that people are starting those websites in, like, grade schools to fire coaches, and I just want to lay down when I hear that. But here's the thing. Dialogue is power, and especially if you're at a public school system, you got an athletic director, you got a principal, and you've got a, you know, a superintendent. Bring it up. Talk about it. And, you know, I went to Catholic schools, and, you know, the equipment wasn't great. You know, it's kind of like, hey, this is what we got. Pick it out of the bin and see what fits. And that's why I kind of like playing tennis. My racket always fit me. So it was all good. But it's the dialogue. It's not, it's the sunshine is the best disinfectant. And I'm not saying coaching, I mean, you know, to your point, for your brother, coaching can be hell. Coaching can be ridiculously insanely hell right now with the demands of parents and kids that are in eighth grade walking out because they want more playing time. And I mean, stuff is happening that is unimaginable, but understanding that you do have power if you're coming from a logical place saying, hey, why are you doing the Oklahoma drill? Are you familiar with, you guys know about the Oklahoma drill? In football, it's literally you get a group of kids together and you have them run into each other, almost like battering rams. And you go home on YouTube, Google the Oklahoma drill. It is still being done. If I walk to a practice, a youth practice, and I see someone doing the Oklahoma drill, I'm raising my hand and stopping it as an adult who knows better. And a lot of parents turn over their kids to coaches and say, make my kid a star. Don't ask about the details, just make it happen. Until we get a little sanity in the conversation of, guess what, most kids aren't going to be the star, and I want them to be safe, happy, and healthy, and functional members of society, no matter where they're, whether they're on the bench or they're starting, that's what you need to come from. But we're never going to disentangle this. I mean, we're too far in. I mean, that would have been, if you had come up in 1940, sir, you would have had it. But it's, again, there's, you know, the stadium at the school. There's a really nice stadium at Pioneer. Who's going to run that?
Well, and Jimmy, I mean, basketball has a great example of separating it, though, and that's maybe the flip side of the coin is AAU. Can you talk about what you've seen in programs that aren't tied directly to a school and are just doing their own thing?
Well, AAU, that's a whole nother animal. When you start separating, again, going back to the Adidas thing, you know, you open yourself up more just because you are then separated from the principal, from the superintendent, from, you know, people that we trust within our local school districts to anyone that can fund or bankroll a team. And then that's where the issues come in again, and we go back through the cyclical problem, and we wonder what the deal is. But really, it's you know, sports is a microcosm of life, and this is an opportunity for wolves to come in and try to take advantage of our children. And if we are not diligent, if we're not vigilant in vetting these teams and watching out for these AAU coaches, and don't support that, they're just going to keep growing. Me personally, I have kids that are teenagers currently in high school, and they do not play AAU. I'm approached every other day to coach an AAU team, to form an AAU team. I will not, because that is something that I don't want to represent. That's something that leads to the same situation that we're talking about. I do not want to exploit the kids. If I run an AAU team, they're going to learn basketball. I'll give you an example. This past year was my first year coaching officially for a public school. Within this 7-month period, I had these kids go from, in 32 years, winning the district, and we started out 0-8. And the reason, how I did it was I changed their mindset. Our first 2 months of practice was in the library. They didn't understand it. I told them, you can't play for me. You cannot play for me if you can't think on a higher level. They didn't understand what I meant. I was like, I have a high-level intricate offense, and if you can't think, you cannot play. And they were like, Coach, we could play. Like, we played all our life. I'm like, you're not understanding what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Basketball is geometry and physics, and if you don't understand that, you can't play for me. So the first 2 months, when they showed up for practice in the gym, I took them to the library to get their grades up and for them to expand their minds. And what that did was get them to be comfortable in knowing that they were handling their business outside of basketball, so then basketball was even more fun for them. And it took off the pressure, because I told them, what good is it for me to teach you basketball and you fail? Like, that's not the purpose here. The purpose, this is physical education. See, y'all don't learn this growing up anymore. We learn that it's physical education. So when you're playing basketball, you're not just learning basketball. I'm teaching you hockey, football, soccer, baseball. There's a whole bunch of strategies that go into this. And if you don't know that, well, you're going to learn. So the way that we indoctrinate these kids now, because we're not educating them. We have to switch from indoctrinate, and that's the problem with society. All we do is indoctrinate. We don't educate. And we also educate without liberating. So what we're doing is putting the kids in the same situation. That's the reason why we have these rifts with what the children are seeing and feeling and what we have experienced and know. And that's why it seems like there's a miscommunication. And so, I'm sorry, I started going off. And I started going off. I know I'm preaching. I'm sorry. But really, though, I think we have to be conscious of who's coaching, what their motives are, and then what we do to support those teams. And if not, then we get a couple of parents, 2 or 3 parents that can lean on each other and can rotate when supervising the league, that you know will be in good hands.
There you go.
John?
Yeah, I'm going to take Jimmy's view on this one, and I'm going to disagree with you on this one, sir, although I see the reasons for, if you're trapped in a bad high school program, a good travel team option is certainly a good one, and I would take it with my kid or myself. My class here at Michigan is the history of college athletics, because I had discovered 20 years ago, stumbling through the Nagano Olympics, that we are the only nation in the world that connects academics and athletics. You've traveled the world. You've seen this. You've played overseas. I was explaining this when I was in the Nagano Olympics, and I explained to these sports writers who know a fair amount about U.S. sports that Michigan that year, in 97, of course, won the national title in football. And they'd say, oh, so you beat the Packers. It's like, no, that's not how this thing works. And I can't begin to explain how this thing works. It starts in 1895, the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago. When the Big Ten was formed, the first formal marriage of academics and athletics anywhere in the world, the Michigan High School Athletic Association starts the next year modeled on the Big Ten. All states, all college conferences are modeled on the Big Ten. All right, that is the original place where it attaches. No doubt there are plenty of problems with high school sports, with high school coaches. We've seen them, the horror stories downright. However, thinking that a travel team is going to solve your problems, when I coached, despite my record, I was coaching at Huron for 4 years. We had 25 games a season. I was responsible for your academics. We had a study table Monday nights every week. Otherwise, you're going to be ineligible. If you're ineligible, you can't play for me, as Jimmy King says. If you don't like that, you join the travel teams. You play 70 games a year. Those coaches don't give a damn about your academics. They don't know about your academics. There's no penalty for you being stupid or dropping out. All right, you're going to play 70 games. They go on weeknights. They go overnight, all this crazy stuff. AAU is 5 kinds of insanity right now. And those coaches are getting paid big money, and they don't care about you. They care about their next job. They're not looking out for you, looking out for their own minor leagues, their own college chances, and all the rest. I would argue you're much safer mentally and physically in a high school program than you are on a travel team. Yep. They're connected to the school. The school's got safeguards. They got trainers. They got lawyers. All right. They got principals who will pull you in if you're out of control. And if you're an out of control travel team coach, you're called a winner, and they don't care about the rest of it. I've seen it.
All right. Well, I'd like to take – we just have a few minutes left, and we have plenty more questions. I'd like to take a few questions. And if you could direct your question to one person, we'll take one answer so we can get two or three in here. There's a gentleman in the back that's been waiting a long time there.
Yeah, mine's more of a comment more than a question. I played Division I basketball as well, and one thing that wasn't mentioned is that when you sign to play for a school, you sign for 4 years. The school actually only commits to you for one. It's a one-year renewable scholarship. So every, July 1st, they have to call you in and say, you know what, we're happy with your performance, and we're going to renew your scholarship for next year. So I've had plenty of teammates that basically didn't perform very well and lost their scholarship, so then they were out. Mm-hmm. So,
yep. Was that directed towards?
Jimmy, you want to respond to that?
And that's 1,000% correct. You sign. Well, when they're recruiting you, the coaches come in and they tell your parents, your loved ones, that you're signing a 4-year scholarship, but in reality, you're signing a 1-year deal. And you're evaluated at the end of the year. If you don't cut it, then you may find yourself somewhere else, no hard feelings, and you learn that it is a business at that point. Everything that they sold you when they're talking about developing you, you're coming into a family and developing you from a boy to a young man or a young man to a man, and it's just not true. I'm going to tell y'all this is 100% true. Coach Fisher, Steve Fisher, I love him to death. He just recently retired, God bless him, had a great career. Brian Dutcher is now the head coach at San Diego State, followed him, was also assistant coach here at Michigan. When we first came here and we walked on Chrysler Arena, Coach Fisher, right? Sweet Steve Fisher, rosy cheek Steve, right? Pulled us into the center court. First thing he said, first day, we haven't ran a drill, anything yet. Pulled us in a circle, looked at us all. He said, I know what I told each and every one of you. I know what I told your parents. I know what I told you. But you're here to do one thing, and that's to play basketball.
Wow.
That's what he said. Now, that didn't mean that our academics, obviously, couldn't slip, but he kept it real with us. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why we played for him, because he told us the truth. He said, y'all here to play basketball, but we're going to make sure that but really, though, you got to play basketball. So you have to keep it in perspective of what the truth is, and again, like we started, we have to have these truths conversations, because if we're not being truthful, we're just kicking up the old BS, and this, we're just going back into the same thing. And I think it's, we're in an era, we're in a time where a lot of the, the strongholds and the, mantras and ideologies that were in the past are no longer. They don't hold anymore. We're finding ourselves in transition. That's why it seems like everybody has to pick a side. You're for paying or you're not. And if you're not, then you're on that side. But really, we're all on the same side. We all have different views. Let's start with the conversation. And from there, we can grow. But it's just like the NFL and Colin Kaepernick. What's the problem with having the conversation? They're just pointing fingers at each other. They're not. It's been a year. It's been a year and a half, y'all. They still ain't had a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another question in the back.
Hi, my name is Janet. I was wondering if Joanne, if you could answer, when you have a team and there is a star player and it's pretty much obvious that their game depends on that star player, and that the other coach says, take him out. If there's ever going to be enough penalties against that kind of behavior to stop it.
Well, first of all, it depends on the sport, obviously. But that's also the other rail of this, is having good officiating. And we are in a crisis right now with youth and high school sports. Nobody wants to be a ref. Why? Because you get paid like, you know, $15, $20 a game. You have people screaming at you. You get chased to the parking lot and have a gun thrown on you because you made a call. So having people that know the game, I mean, I'm not saying be ticky-tack and call every single foul and paralyze the game. But if you see, if the referees see, and honestly, if anyone hears this, like at the scorer's table, I think they have a moral obligation to say something, because you can kill somebody. If you're in lacrosse, you have a weapon in your hand. Hockey, you've got razor blades on your feet and a stick in your hands. Football, you could literally, you know, break somebody's neck. I'm not trying to be dramatic, but when you say take somebody out, somebody might actually listen and do something they regret for the rest of their lives. So we need referees to take control of that situation, absolutely.
All right, one more question right here in the third row.
Greg Stayskull.
Thanks, John. Hi, Jimmy. I haven't seen you for a while.
How you doing? See.
I wanted to make the distinction, and I think you did later, with the situation with AAU and the stuff with this Adidas thing. The investigation that the FBI did, and basically the reason they're even involved, NCAA is incapable of doing an investigation, but it involved, because I think it can be confused that, the players are getting money, but in this case, it's primarily to the recruiting violations are the problem, and that's what needs to be cleaned up, and as you pointed out, AAU is corrupt in that way as well. And that's the big problem. The money isn't necessarily going to the players. It's going to the benefit of those schools for the recruiting violations. And that's the reason that they were involved. And that's the reason we were involved with Eddie Martin as well. So,
John, any thoughts to add there?
Perhaps know Greg Stayskull, who played football at Nebraska. He's an FBI agent, former. He's on the team. I know that story right there. That I know him through sports, I swear to God. Not through the FBI, of course. He started the steroids investigation back in 1988, I believe, because Bo Schembechler were playing against Michigan State and Tony Mandarich. Bo said, I don't recruit that well, but I don't recruit that badly. Why are their players twice as big as my players? That cannot be right. And he asked his friend Greg Stayskull to start the conversation, if you will. And they started a whole steroid investigation, started with that man right there, and Bo Schembechler. And they discovered there's quite a few steroids, of course, in football. But they quickly discovered that baseball was rampant. So the whole baseball investigation that brought down Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds and all the rest, it started with Bo Schembechler and Greg Stayskull right here in the third row. So there's a little history for you.
Well, that seems like a good note to end on. Could we have a round of applause again for Zingerman's Gray Line for hosting us tonight? Before we close, I want to thank all of you for coming out, and I want to wish you all a happy and safe Thanksgiving. And could we have a warm round of applause for our very excellent panel tonight? Thank you very much. Have a safe holiday.